Okay, so we're beginning Perek Dalet, Sefer Shoftim, Pasuk Aleph, Vayosifu b'nei Yisrael ha'asos hara b'inei Hashem ve'ehud meis. I'm going to take a sefer actually, because we're going to look at the end of Perek Gimel. So the Navi says that the b'nei Yisrael continued to do evil in the eyes of Hashem, and Ehud died. So if you look at this Pasuk in a vacuum, it seems, you know, not such a big deal, but... many of the Mefarshim point out, sir?
Last pasuk in the previous.
Oh. Very good.
What happened to him?
Good, very good.
Where did he disappear to?
Excellent, good.
What happened to him?
Very good, very good. So the very last pasuk of Perek Gimel says, we'll just read the pasuk again, in pasuk Lamed Aleph. The acharav haya shamgar ben anas, that after Ehud, right, the Navi does not describe Ehud's death in Perek Gimel. It just says that Ehud, he defeated Moab, and then Moab was subjugated to Bnei Yisrael, and things were quiet for 80 years. And then it says that after Ehud came along, this guy Shamgar ben Anas, right? He was the next Shofet, and he defeated the Plishtim with 600 men with this cattle prod, right? Vayosha gamhu es Yisrael, and then. The pasuk in the first pasuk in Perek Dalet, Vayosuf bnei Yisrael ha'asos hara b'nei Hashem, ve'ehud meis. Well, what happened to Shamgar? Right?
Maybe we were just. Alive.
I'm sorry.
Maybe he's still alive.
Yeah, but this is a very strange thing. Meaning, so what?
It seems out of context. The whole thing.
Yeah. Why?
Because first you should have talked about him dying, and then.
Meaning, first talk about Ehud dying, and then talk about Shamgar. You know, Shamgar taking over, and then we'll figure out what happens to Shamgar. I mean, let's do one at a time, right? What are we? We're going back and forth.
Who's the story before Ehud?
Othniel.
So, does it have the same style where it says they
no.
Dead, then they got saved, and then there was quiet?
No, but it's in order. I mean, I don't remember the exact, we could look back.
No, but I'm looking at the way...
Here, look at Pasuk, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud Aleph.
Right.
Vatishkot ha'aretz arboim shana vayomos Othniel ben Kenaz. Right, so things were quiet for 40 years. Othniel dies, and then Vayosifu bnei Yisrael asos hara b'nei Hashem, Eglon, and then came along Ehud. So that makes sense. That order makes sense, right?
But then after Ehud, it says the same thing.
But it doesn't say Ehud dies.
No, but
it just says Vatishkot haaretz shmonim shana, right?
Right. But here after Ehud, after seeing the two shoftim who were before now. They said the land became quiet.
Right.
And then here, but after Shamgar, it doesn't say anything about him.
Correct.
He was a champion. Doesn't say the land became quiet with him.
Correct.
Doesn't say anything.
Correct.
That's it.
Right. Very good.
Why did he even mention him?
Good.
What did he do?
Right. Okay. Good. Good. Good questions. So basically, the way the Radak understands what's going on here is that and I'm taking into. I left my notes in Perek Gimel, but I'm taking into account something that some of the Mefarshim say. I don't remember now offhand who says this at the end of Perek Gimel. It might be the Malbim or Radak. I don't remember now offhand who said it. But basically, what they say is that if you remember, the Malbim introduced Sefer Shoftim by saying that sometimes the Shofet succeeded and everything was quiet throughout the rest of his life.
Right.
And then he died. But sometimes, already at the end of his life, things started to deteriorate already.
And they say already.
Yes, the Pesukim say, even when he was still alive. So some of the Mefarshim say that Ehud was successful, right? The land was quiet 80 years, it says. But already at the end of Ehud's life, things began to deteriorate.
Mm-hmm.
Ehud was still alive. Things began to deteriorate. Now, Ehud was too old at that point to really step up the way that he did, right? He came in and he defeated Eglon, he defeated Moab. Ehud at this point was too old, so he couldn't really step up anymore. So that's why another Shofet had to come along by the name of Shamgar, who then, he was the one who stepped to the plate even during Ehud's lifetime. Okay, he was the one who then fought back against the Plishtim, so he stemmed the tide, so to speak. Ehud was still alive. And then Shamgar... Only the Mefarshim say Shamgar only lasted a year and then he died. But Shamgar was alive was in charge for a very short period of time.
He says the Radak says Ehud the lion didn't keep quiet. But it says it was, you know, about
it was quiet. It says it was quiet. But then, the pasuk doesn't say this, but this is how the mafreshim understand, that things began to deteriorate slowly. So then Shamgar steps in, because Ehud's too old, so Shamgar steps in, and he stems the tide. You know, and he defeats the plishim. He kind of fights back a little bit.
Why doesn't it say V'tishkod ha'aretz
b'hem? Oh, very good. So the Radak says that here it just says V'yosha gam hu es Yisrael, that he also saved Yisrael. So he says the change in language that with Shamgar it only says V'yosha is because with Shamgar it was not a complete victory. Right? Even with Shamgar, he kind of like, you know, the tide was beginning to change and Shamgar pushed it back a little bit, but it wasn't complete. Now Shamgar didn't have a complete, you know, a complete victory the way that Ehud in his early years did. You know, Ehud completely silenced, he defeated Moab, everything was quiet, everything was good. Right?
But they wouldn't say it anyway if he died within the year after. It wasn't a long period of time.
It wasn't a long period of time, right? Also true. Right, also true. But basically that's how the Mefarshim understand it. So Ehud is older, things begin to deteriorate, Shamgar steps in, he stems the tide a little bit, he pushes things back, but not a complete victory. Vayosha.
What is that?
That's a good question. It seems like that you know the Jews began to sin again. Bnei Yisrael, you know, began to sin again. This is the cycle. Whenever Bnei Yisrael sins, so then the nations of the other nations begin to rule over them.
So
here, in this case, by Shamgar was the Plishtim.
This is what I'm trying to connect. No place does it talk about any of these people, any of the Shoftim, being Nevi'im. Or being Sadiq.
Correct.
And
correct.
Everybody. So.
Correct.
If Bnei Yisrael was starting to deteriorate, why is Hashem helping him win battles?
Right. Okay.
So my logic would be the other way, really. And who appointed these people to be shoftim in the first place?
Right.
I don't. You know, there's like no nothing right. Appointing anybody.
No. Correct. Correct. So in most cases, it just says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent them. Right in the beginning, by Ehud, it says. Pasuk Tes Vav in Perek Yimel Vayokim Hashem Lohem Moshia Es Ehud. So Hashem appointed him. Now there was no like sign.
Not you, but through whom? I
mean, no, it's
saying.
It seems like what it sounds like. The Mefarshim don't describe exactly the process how the Shoftim came to power, but it seems like the Shoftim just, you know, took charge. In other words, they were divinely inspired. You know, that hey, I can, you know, I think I can make a difference here, I can take charge. And they stepped up and they took charge and everybody listened. That's what it sounds like. Now, it was divinely ordained. This was HaKadosh Baruch Hu working behind the scenes, you know, promoting this person and ensuring that everybody went along with it.
These Shoftim basically were righteous people that basically changed. So all of them were basically righteous.
That's what it seems like right now.
It doesn't say this anywhere.
Right. I mean, we'll see throughout the Sefer how things go. But right now, it does seem that way. We don't see that they're Nevi'im. Osniel ben Kenaz, we learned, we had the Midrashim that said how he was a big tzaddik and a Talmid Chacham, etc. Right? Ehud, you know, we found a little bit, right? The Midrashim said a little bit that he was focused on the Zechus of the Torah, that he felt that was going to save them. So you see a little bit his righteousness. Shamgar, we see very little. You know, it's only one pasuk pretty much that discusses Shamgar, so we don't really see much about him at all. No, so we don't really see much about him at all. And obviously, Devorah, we're going to see a lot about. But you know, it seems that they were righteous people, and they did get Bnei Yisrael to improve their ways. Now, you know, it was a little bit, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Because in order for the Nevi'im to come about. I'm sorry, for the Shoftim to come about. So the Psukim always say that Bnei Yisrael was already doing tshuva, it sounds like. Vayizaku al Hashem, Vayitzaku al Hashem, right? They cried out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings the Shofet, and the Shofet steps in and saves them. So it seems that that's, you know, they're already doing tshuva. You know, once they're being beaten so hard by these nations, they're already doing tshuva. They're already doing tshuva, and now HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings a Shofet who kind of helps them along and defeats the enemy for them. So that seems to be what the cycle is. But, okay, but that's the... That's the time. That's basically the approach that many of the Mefarshim say. The Malbim points out that's also why if you look back at Pasuk Lamed at the end of Perek Gimel, it says Vatikana Moav Bayom Hahu Tachas Yad Yisrael. That Moav on that day was subjugated, right, to Bnei Yisrael. Why does it say Bayom Hahu? So the Malbim says because it was temporary. Bayom Hahu means that day. In that day, Moav was under Jewish rule. But that began to unravel, right? That began to change slowly over time. even throughout the lifetime of Ehud. And he says, so this answers, Erwin, this answers your question a little bit. The Malbim also says that as long as Ehud was alive, his chus kept things afloat. I mean, even though Bnei Yisrael started to sin, but the chus of Ehud kept things, you know, kind of in check. Where Shamgar was able to come in and able to stem the tide of the Plishtim and defeat the Plishtim. So that was all in the chus of Ehud still being alive. Once Ehud dies, that's the first pasuk in our parak, now things really, you know, begin to deteriorate very quickly. Okay? So that's what that's how the Mefarshim, you know, pretty much understand the timeline here. Okay. Pasuk Beis. Vayim kerem Hashem b'yad Yavin melech Kenan asher malach b'chatzor. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we've seen this language before of Vayim kerem. It doesn't mean an actual sale, but it means that Hashem gave them over to essentially to in the hands of Yavin, this king of Kenan, Yavin, the king of Kenan, who ruled in this place called Chatzor, the Sar Tzva'o Sisra. So that's a name that we all recognize, right? The name that that his general was Sisra, v'hu yoshev b'charoshes hagoyim, and he settled in this place called Charoshes Hagoyim. Rashi says it was the name of the city, and we'll see some of the ideas behind this name. So interestingly, many of the Mefarshim point out that if you look back at Sefer Yehoshua, right? So here we're already talking about the Kenani, right? Yavin Melech Kenan. So the Radak points out that Yehoshua already defeated them. Right? If you look back at Sefer Yehoshua, Yehoshua defeated Kenan. He says if you look, Yavin was actually the name of the Kenani king that Yehoshua defeated. Chatzor was the name of the place. Yehoshua burned it to the ground after he defeated it. Right? So, you know, what happened over here? You know, how'd they come back? You know, it seems like almost they had a resurgence. You know, Yehoshua defeated them and then they came back. So the Radak says that that's exactly what happened. Yehoshua defeated them. He killed, right? The Radak says he killed the king called Yavin. That was his name. Yavin Melech Kenan. He killed him. He burned down the city of Chatzor, okay, to the ground. There were a couple of survivors who escaped, okay? And the Radak says that those survivors went to this place called Charoshes Hagoyim, right? They fled. They regrouped in Charoshes Hagoyim, in this place. They resettled over there, and they rebuilt their community. Right? They rebuilt their community, and they grew over time. And this current king, whose name was Yavin, was not the same Yavin as the king then, but it was the same name. It almost sounds like almost like Paro, you know, like in every generation, right? The Mitzrayim had a Paro, so this was like the name of the king of Canaan, Yavin Melech Canaan. So the first one of them was killed in Yoshua's time. This was another Yavin Melech Canaan. That's the way the Radak says it. It's interesting. It's not everyone agrees. The Mitzudas David says that this was the same king, and he says Yehoshua didn't kill him. Even though, and he says, if you look at the pasuk in Yehoshua, the pasuk seems to indicate he killed him. He says no, the killing in that pasuk is going back on the inhabitants of the city. It's not referring to the king. The king escaped, right? So Yehoshua killed the people of the Canaanim in Chatzor, but the king of the city escaped and he regrouped, right, and recreated and rebuilt his empire in this place called Charoshes Hagoyim. The question is why is it called Charoshes Hagoyim? It's a very interesting name, you know. The language, you know, the word Charoshes, like Charosh is almost like, you know, is Choresh is like to plow. You know, some sort of a farming in the Hagoyim of the nations. So the Rabbah gives like three different interpretations of why this place was called Charoshes Hagoyim. He says it could be that it was a very fortified city, and many of the nations came together as they saw Bnei Yisrael being successful and defeating, you know, city after city, nation after nation. So several nations got together and built a fortified city, and that was called Charoshes Hagoyim. This was the fortified city of the nations, and it was fortified because of Bnei Yisrael. Because they, you know, they built this to protect themselves from Bnei Yisrael. He says also that perhaps it was a very large city and very big cities. You have every field and profession represented. Maybe that's why also Charoshes. It's like it was like every field, every craft, every profession that could exist existed in this place because it was such a big city. It's like, you know, Manhattan. You could find anything in Manhattan. You know, you go to a small town, you're not going to find everything. But in Manhattan, you find everything. So here too, Charoshes Hagoyim was a very big city. And they had everything there. You know, you could find everything. Finally, he suggests that maybe it's not the name of a city. Maybe it's a very large province. And in this province, he had, you know, many different cities. And each city had its own king. And that's why it's called Charoshes Hagoyim. It's like the province of all the nations. And all the nations, you know, had cities in this province with these kings. He brings a proof. He says, if you look at Shiras Devorah, which is Perakeh, which we'll get to in a couple of weeks. So Devorah talks about many kings coming. So he says, where's the many kings? There's one king here. Yavin Melech Kenan. That's it. Where are the many kings? So he says, maybe it's because that really there was a big province here in many of the cities. So meaning there were several kings. Only one of them is, you know, Yavin maybe was the chief. But there were several other kings as well. The Malbim here makes a fascinating point, and he says that if you think about it, who were the first nations to come back and begin defeating Bnei Yisrael after the glory days of Yahushua? Things start to unravel a little bit during the times of the Shoftim. Who were the first couple of nations? We have Moab, right? Moab brings in Amalek and Ammon. We have the Plishtim at the very end of Perek Gimel. Who are these nations? These are nations from outside of the land of Israel. Here, it's the Kanani. Here it's the Kanani. Here it's one of the seven nations. So the Malbim says that this already, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was waiting. He's doing this slowly. You know, first he allows the other nations, you know, from outside of Eretz Yisrael to come in and to start defeating Bnei Yisrael. But now, you know, things are really getting bad. Now already the Kanani, now already the seven nations of Eretz Yisrael already now going to begin persecuting Bnei Yisrael and oppressing Bnei Yisrael, defeating Bnei Yisrael. And he says, these are the psukim. We saw these psukim back in Perek Beis. We saw, what did the Navi say to Bnei Yisrael? If you leave them here, they're going to cause problems for you. And this is what's happening. This is a kiyum of that nevuah that the Nevi'im told Bnei Yisrael. Okay. The Malbim also, it's interesting, he's of the opinion also that Yavin, Melech Kenan, was the same king, and he says that he was angry. You know, Yavin was angry because of what Yahushua did to his city. You know, he wiped out his city and he made him flee. So Yavin has been planning his revenge all these years. That's how the Malbim understands also what's going on here.
So Yavin had to be like 100.
An old, yeah, I know. I don't know exactly how old he was, but I'm trying to think of the timing.
At least with one shofet.
Yeah.
And you had, I forgot how many in another. You
right.
Get them together. It's close to 200 years.
You're saying the years don't add up. The years don't add up. I mean, Yahushua died, he was 110, right? So people still live long lives, but the question is that long? Is he already pushing it?
Sure, when he started
conquering, is he already pushing it?
Was he like 80 years old or something, like 90 years old?
Right.
Okay, so that's 20, 30 years.
I hear you.
Another 150,
right.
200
years. You have to do the math and see if it works out. I hear what you're saying. Okay, maybe that's what pushed many of the Mefarshim to say that, like the Radak says, it was a different king. You know, it was years later, it was a different king, but... Okay. Pasuk Gimel. Vayitz'aku Bnei Yisrael al Hashem. So Bnei Yisrael begins to, again, this is the cycle, they start crying out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ki tesha me'os rechev barzel lo. They're scared, they're petrified of Sisera. Sisera has 900 tanks, essentially, right? Rechev barzel is iron chariots. You know, it's interesting, the Mitzudas Tzion says they weren't actually made out of barzel. It just means they were very strong. You know, when you think of something that's strong, you think of iron. You know, now, I mean, nowadays people would say steel, right? You know, man of steel. But so in those days it was iron. So iron was so here it just means that they were strong chariots. They were very powerful chariots. Not that they were actually made out of iron. But here you have these basically 900 tanks. That was what Sisera had. He had quite the artillery, quite the army. The hu lachatz es bnei Yisrael b'chazka esrim shana. And he was, lochatz is like he was pressuring them. He was pressing on them. Many of the Mefarshim, Rashi says this, and the Mitzudas David also says this, that this he wasn't physically, you know, they conquered them and they were ruling over them, but it's not like they were beating them or physically enslaving them. He says, but he was verbally abusing them. And he was like mocking them, you know, constantly. He would be mocking Bnei Yisrael and taunting Bnei Yisrael. It was like verbal abuse for 20 years, you know, emotional verbal abuse for 20 years. The Malbim also says here that here the pasuk says vayitzaku, and he says in other places it says vayizaku with a zayin. So you ever wonder why sometimes it says zaka and sometimes it says tzaka? What's the difference? So the Malbim says there is a difference. He says tzi'aka with a tzadi is a much more powerful. It's like a more powerful cry and scream than tzi'aka. And he says here that there were three reasons why Bnei Yisrael, screamed in a stronger way. Number one, that they had a very strong army, right? Sisera, 900 tanks. Bnei Yisrael felt like we have no chance. right? They were intimidated. They were scared. We have no chance. You know, according to the rules of nature, we have no way of defeating this king and his general. Number one. Number two, the verbal abuse, right? That he would just taunt and mock them. It got to them. It got into their heads. It worked. You know, he was like trying to get into their heads, and it was working. And also that it carried on for 20 years. You know, and it was like a long time of putting them down and mocking them and taunting them and verbally abusing them. It's interesting because normally you would think, okay, well, like, what's the big deal? You know, you let it slide. But you see that after 20 years of someone verbally abusing someone, mocking someone, taunting someone, you know, it does damage. It gets into the person's head. You know, you talk nowadays about, you know, there's a lot of talk. Everybody's talking about, you know. That's what it sounds like. They weren't physically, I mean, they ruled over them. You know,
they said they had 900 chariots to keep them in check.
Well, they were, yeah, exactly, exactly. They were just there, you know, they were there, you know, make sure you don't do anything wrong. Make sure you don't make any wrong moves, because we have the tanks here. But really, it was just a verbal thing. But you see also, like nowadays, you know, with all the talk of bullying and verbal abuse in schools and with kids, you know, and you see that even in times of the Navi, this was something real. You know, we don't go with the American dictum of sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. You know, we don't believe in that. We believe that it's something real. It causes emotional damage, and it can get into someone's head. And here, vayitzaku, right? The Malbim says the Navi uses a stronger word, vayitzaku, because the Bnei Yisrael was so, you know, petrified and you know, just emotionally scarred from Sisra and his antics. Okay, Pasuk Dalet, we're introduced to Devora. Udevora isha neviya, eshes lapidos. So now Devora was a neviya, and this is interesting because until now we've had Osniel, we've had Ehud, we've had Shamgar. Nobody was a navi. It didn't say any of them were neviya. They were shoftim. They were leaders, right? They were religious leaders. They were military leaders. They weren't neviya. Here, all of a sudden, the first one comes along. We have a neviya. We have a woman who's a neviya, Devora.
First woman.
She was the first woman, and she was a neviya, right? Aishes Lapidos, she's the wife of Lapidos, and we'll talk more about Lapidos and what that means. He shofta es Yisrael ba'esahi, and she was the one who was the shofet for Bnei Yisrael at that time. Okay, now what's this, Aishes Lapidos? Well, what does it mean that she was an Aishes Lapidos? Well, actually, before we get there, let's talk about the fact that she was a Nevi'a first.
Is that his name?
I'm sorry? It seems like that's his name, but we'll see in a second. So the Ralbag says here that she was an Isha Nevi'ah. He says if she was a Nevi'ah, right, and it also says that she was a Shofetes, right, that's what it says at the end of the Pasuk. So she had a dual role. She was a Nevi'ah, she was a prophetess, and she was a Shofetes, she was a judge, right? She had this dual role. And the Ralbag says if this was the case, she must have been encouraging them to do tshuva already, right? If she was a prophet, she was a prophetess, and she was a judge. Right, it's not like, you know, she just came onto the scene and, you know, said, hey, you know, what's going on here, and just took charge. She must have been already, you know, encouraging people, rebuking people, getting people to do tshuva, because otherwise, you know, you don't have a prophet and a judge flying under the radar. So she must have already been active in public life and trying to get people to do tshuva. And he says that's probably why they started doing tshuva. Even though the Psukim don't say that in that order, first the Pasuk in Gimel, it says Vayitzaku, and then we're introduced to Devora. He says it must be that Devora was already around, and she was causing them to think about things and to do tshuva, and therefore Vayitzaku, and therefore they cried out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
Rabbi,
yeah.
Political correctness.
Yeah.
Why, when describing the other Navis, it doesn't say Ish, but with Devora it says that she is a woman?
Because the other ones are obvious, and this one's not. No problem.
Why? Devora is not a man's name. Devora is a woman's name.
Right. You're saying, just say Devora. We know it's a woman.
The only reason you know it's a woman's name, by the way, is because
I don't know.
You know the story of Devora. If you know the story of Devora and the name just comes up, you never would have known.
So just because it ends with a hey, does that mean it's a feminine name necessarily?
I think a woman would be upset today.
Oh, yes, that's true. Yeah.
What, because it calls her a woman?
Because why differentiate all of a sudden? Previously, you didn't say Ish.
Okay.
Now you're saying Isha.
I don't know. Well, I mean,
men are expected.
Again, it wasn't. It certainly wasn't the norm
for a woman.
It certainly wasn't the norm. I mean, you look throughout Shoftim. I mean, she's the only one, right? I mean, we find here in this story we have in this story the women dominate because we have Devorah, and then we have Yael coming up, who's going to play a very central role in the victory, right? Later, right? Later, we have other women.
President, you're sure. You'd say the woman, right? You wouldn't say.
And it could be that what everyone's saying is right. That just because this is something that was different than the Shoftim that had preceded her, right? Even though, I mean, we find women who had leadership roles. Miriam, right, in the Torah. Miriam was, Miriam was a Neviah. You know, we have the Imahos, obviously, earlier in the Chumash. So we have women who had leadership roles. But in terms of being the leader of Klal Yisrael, this was something different. This was something that was out of the norm.
Not only is her name Devorah, but she happens to be the Neviah and a woman.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
Is there a halakhic restriction on a woman being a judge?
So there is from a legal standpoint. Now, what exactly, how that works with this is a good question. I'm not 100% sure. I'm not 100% sure, but yeah. But there is, you know, yeah. It's a good question. It's a good question.
What did she judge them on? Judge them, meaning judge them,
It's not clear exactly. I mean, she was Shofta. I mean, Shofta means she was judging. So they speak about that. You know, the Mefarshim talk about the fact that she was judging. What exactly she was judging? It's not clear. It's not clear.
Not a Sagdola or anything yet. You know, that came later.
No. Yeah. Right. Of course, she had Nevuah. It's Isha Nevuah. She was a Nevuah. Yeah. I mean, we're about to hear some of the Nevuah that she's going to share. But she was definitely a Nevuah. The question is, in terms of that, you know. What was the restriction? What exactly did she do? It's not 100% clear, but it's a good question. It's a good question. I'm not 100% sure, but I have to see. I feel like there must be people who talk about it. None of the Mefarshim here discuss this. They don't address it, but I feel like it's got to be discussed. It's, you know, somewhere.
And there may also be an issue of sineas.
Well, so that will touch on. That will touch on. We'll come to that in a second. Okay. So let's see some of this. Let's start with the Al-Sheikh. Okay. So many of the Mefarshim here to talk about the fact that that it calls her Ashes Lapidos, that she was the wife of Lapidos. So Pashup Shat, you would say, well, it's just, Ashes Lapidos just means that she was the wife of this fellow named Lapidos, and that's the end of it. The problem is that, you know, it seems, first of all, you don't see anything else in the Psukim about this guy, Lapidos, right? You know, he's not mentioned, besides for this Pasuk, which is Pasuk Dalid, you don't find any other mention of anybody named Lapidos anywhere. Right, so it seems kind of strange, you know. What happened? There's only one mention that she was the wife of Lapidos, and that was it. Meaning, is it significant? If that was his name, that he was a fellow named Lapidos, so if he's not significant, why mention him at all? That's why I say who she was the wife of if he's not a significant figure at all. So many of the Mefarshim and the Midrashim all say that Lapidos was another name for Barak. Okay, Barak is a very central figure that we're going to see in a moment. But many of the Mefarshim say, they quote the Midrashim. The Midrashim already say this. They didn't make this up. Is that Barak was Lapidos, and Barak was and she was the wife of Barak. That's what many of the Mefarshim say. Others say that again, not everyone understands it this way. That's one group of Rishonim understand that she was the wife of Barak, and Barak was called Lapidos. And we'll talk a little bit about why maybe he was called Lapidos. The other option, and there's a medrash like this as well, is that Lapidos was not Barak, a different person, right? Named Lapidos. Why was she called Lapidos? So the medrash, the very interesting medrash. The medrash says that based on a Tana Devei Eliyahu, there's different makoros about this, but many say that her husband was an Amoretz, Now, she was like, you know, she clearly, not only did she lead B'nai Yisrael, but even in their marriage, you know, her, she was the Shofetes and the Neviah, and her husband was an Amoretz. He wasn't much of anything. And in fact, it says that she, you know, wanted him to have some sort of schus as well, you know, because she was such a great person in her own right, and she felt like, you know, she wanted to enable him to do something as well. And what did she do? So she used to make wicks for the Beis HaMikdash. Lapidos, the word lapid, is the lapid esh, like a flame. So she would make wicks for the Beis HaMikdash, and the Beis HaMikdash at that time was in Shiloh, and she would give it to her husband and say, go bring these wicks to the Beis HaMikdash, and he would provide the Beis HaMikdash with wicks. This was his job and his zechus. And the Midrashim point out that this was like a, you know, this was a big zechus for her, because you could imagine a woman who's so powerful and so important. You know, she's a Neviah, she's a Shofetes, and her husband is like a little bit of a Nebuchal, you know, he's a little bit of a Lo Yutzlach, you know, he's not such a successful guy. So she could, she could have just ignored him. She could have just said, okay, like, I'm the boss, right? I'm the one in charge. He's the Nach Schlepper, you know, so let him do whatever he wants to do. But she, you know, I have bigger things to worry about. I have Klal Yisrael to worry about. You know, I have to worry about, you know, this, and worry about disputes between people, and worry about Nevuah, and worry about all these big things. I don't have time to worry about, you know, my little husband, who's not such a hush of a person. But here you see that even Devorah, who had so much on her plate, who was a Neviah, and who was a Shofetes, and was involved in Klal Yisrael and Klal work, she still cared about, you know, about everyone. I mean, even her husband, who wasn't such a great guy, she wanted him to have a schus. She looked out for him, she went out of her way, you know, something that was totally, this was not her, you know, she didn't need this. She didn't need to make wicks for the Beis HaMikdash. She had, so to speak, bigger fish to fry. You know, she was leading, she was judging, she was, you know, doing bigger things. But even this, she wanted to make sure that he had something. She wanted to make sure that he had a place. Now, he was her husband, but still, it shows the care and concern that she had for each and every person to make sure that he had a place, that he had a schus, that he had something to do. Okay, within that medrash, it's interesting that some say that she made the wicks very thick. She wanted them to, that's why he calls it a lapid. Lapid esh is like almost like a torch. You know, she wanted the wicks to be very thick, that it should be, you know, a beautiful fire for the Beis HaMikdash. And because of that, because she cared about how the fire in the Beis HaMikdash looked, so she was also rewarded with a certain light over B'nai Yisrael. And some of her rule over B'nai Yisrael was in the merit of the fact that she was looking out for the light, so to speak, in the Beis HaMikdash. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave her own light over Yehuda, Yerushalayim, the 12 Shvatim, and some also say that it's that she made her husband Zelchet HaOlam Haba. Again, he was an Amoritz. He didn't have his own merits to ride on, but she was the one who provided him with his ticket to Olam Haba, so to speak. And they quote the pasuk in Mishlei, Chachmas Nashim Aban Sabesa, that the wisdom of women, that's what builds homes, that's what builds houses. And here, this fellow who was, you know, he was a regular Joe, he wasn't anything special. But because of her wisdom, in a quiet way, she enabled him to greatness. And that's part of the chachma of women to enable others to become great. Okay. Some say she also got Nevuah as a reward for this. Fine. Okay. Then again, the other camp is all of the opinion that this was really Barak, and Barak was really the same person as Lapidos. In fact, some also call the Tana Devei Elio that Barak had three names. Barak, and apparently because it says like his face resembled Barak is lightning, so his face resembled lightning. I'm not clear exactly what that means. He also had the name Michael, because Michael was, you know, that he humbled himself also after the angel Michael.
Where did they get the Barak from?
What do you mean?
Where did they get Barak from?
I mean, well, Barak is in the Navi. We're about to see it.
Lightning.
Oh, the name is in the Navi. Now, if you look at the next pasuk, right? Yeah, two psukim. Sorry. No, that's fine. Two psukim ahead, it says Vatikra le Barak ben Avinoam. So that was his name in the Navi.
That means Lapidos has to be not his name.
Well, so this Medrash says that his name was also Lapidos. He had three names. He was known as Barak, Michael, and Lapidos, and all symbolized the different things. Lapidos, maybe his wife, maybe he was really the same person as the wife, you know, that his wife made the wicks. It was the same person, really. So there's a few different interpretations in terms of what his name is. Okay. Now it's interesting. The Al-Sheikh says here that the psukim here are also alluding to, and we'll see also in Pasuk Hey, the psukim are alluding to the fact that there were some people who were hesitant. Right? Again, this was something new. Right? They never had a woman who was in charge before. They never had a woman who was the shofetis before. They didn't have a woman who was the Nevi'ah. I mean, they had Nevi'os, but not the Nevi'ah. Right? Not, you know, we had Miriam, but we also had Moshe and Aaron at the same time. You know, we had the Imahos, but we also had the Avos at the same time. Here you have, there's no man really in charge. There's no Navi who's really in the prime here. It's just her. And the Al-Sheikh says that there were people who were hesitant. There were people who were hesitant. He says technically there was a technical issue that when a woman is a Nida, she can't get Nevuah. So some people were worried, well, what's going to happen? She's going to be a Nida. She's going to be with her husband. She can't get Nevuah. As we saw that Moshe Rabbeinu had to separate from his wife, right? There's two issues. There's the issue of Nida, and there's also the issue of just being together with her husband. You know, that what's going to happen? She's not going to be able to lead. You know, so people were concerned about that. And it says also people were concerned about Yichud. Right, because a lot of times you go to the Navi, you want to have a private meeting, you want to have a personal meeting, and they were concerned about Yichud, which relates to the Tznius question that you raised before. So people were a little bit hesitant to come to her, and he says that's what the pasuk is saying. Udvora isha neviya eishes lapidos, he shoftes Yisrael ba'esahi. That she had these two qualities, that she was a neviya and she was a shoftes, but people were a little bit hesitant. So he says that people actually, that sometimes people did not come to her as a Nevi'ah. We'll see that she shared her Nevu'ah in a minute, she shared it with Barak, but people didn't come to her so readily with Nevu'ah because they were a little bit nervous and they were hesitant. But Shofetes, we see that they did come to her, and we'll see that in a second, that she accommodated for the Tznius and for the Yichud issue. So if you look at Pasuk Hey, so what does it say? V'hi yosheves tachas tomer devora. So where would she sit? Right? She would sit, she would dwell beneath the palm tree, the date palm, which was, and it calls it the date palm of Devora. It's an interesting way of describing it. But the date palm of Devora, Bein HaRama uBein Beis El, Bahar Ephraim, it was between these two places called Rama and Beis El in the mountains of Ephraim, Vayalu Eileha B'nei Yisrael HaMishpat. And people came from Mishpat, and it sounds like she actually judged. She judged cases. This imagery of the tree, of this palm tree, is an interesting imagery. So Rashi says here that she actually owned palm trees. She owned palm trees. He quotes also the Targum Yonasan, but it says that she lived near Yericho. That this is near Yericho, this is outside of Yericho, and she owned palm trees there. And that she would situate herself under this palm tree. That's where she would sit, and that's where she would judge. Targum Yonasan seems to say that this is not referring to where she lived, but it means that she was a very wealthy person. She made her living from trees. She had these palm trees. It says also she had other types of trees. She had vineyards and she had olive trees. So in addition to being a Nevi'ah and a Shofetis, it sounds like she was also a successful businesswoman. You know, that's where the Targum Yonasan seems to put it. You know, she really had it all, Devora. But this is where she situated herself. The Al-Sheikh says that the reason why it says it here is because this is to deal with the Yichud problem. That normally you would come, where would you come to the Shofet? In his chambers, right? So he's sitting in his office or in his courtroom or wherever, and you would come if you have a problem, you come to him, and that's where you would be. But there was a Yichud question, there was a Tznius question, so because of that, she used to sit alone, but in public. Right, she would sit outside where everybody could see, so there was no tznius issue, there was no yichud issue. She would accommodate for that, and that's where she would sit. The Malbim points out here that there are several reasons why Bnei Yisrael were saved here. There were four reasons. So he says, number one, they cried out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what we saw in Pasuk Gimel. Number two, she was zelcha to be a Nevi'ah, whereas the previous shoftim were not Nevi'im, right? They were shoftim, they were leaders, they were military, as we said, military leaders and religious leaders, but they were not Nevi'im. Here she was a Nevi'ah, so that was benefit number two, right? Going in Klal Yisrael's direction. Number three, says the Malbim, reason number three why they were Zocha to a Yeshua is because she was judging them. She was a shofetus. She was helping them improve. When you have a shofetus, you have someone judging, that helps to improve. That helps to improve Klal Yisrael, help them do tshuva, help them do things better. That's number three. And number four, she says that it was also in the Zchus of Bnei Yisrael. That here, Bnei Yisrael, he says, if you look at the other shoftim, many of the other shoftim, they had to go travel around. He says, especially Shmuel. You look at Shmuel. Shmuel was the Navi, but he used to go traveling around Eretz Yisrael to give chizuk and to speak and to meet with people. And here, people came to her. People came to her, and because of that, that might also be a tznius thing that people recognize that maybe it's better if we come to her as opposed to her having to schlep around the whole country, herself. So we came to her, and because of that, Bnei Yisrael, that added to the schus of Bnei Yisrael that they merited to have a Yeshua. Two very interesting Mamori Chazal that the Malbim quotes. Number one, what's the significance of the date palm? So the Gemara in Sukkah says that a date palm has one trunk. It's not like, other trees. You look at the tree, so there's a trunk, and then there's branches going this way, branches going that way. Date palms, you have one trunk that goes up to the top, and then at the very top you have some branches, the fronds or whatever you call them, branching out. But it's pretty much, one trunk almost all the way up. So he says that so too, Bnei Yisrael were extremely unified at this time. They were unified in their service to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which wasn't always the case. But here, just like this date palm is just one unified trunk, so too they were unified. And the Tana Devei Eliyahu Rabbah, the Malbim also quotes, he says that at this time, he says the date palm doesn't provide a lot of shade, right? It's not a very leafy tree. It doesn't provide a lot of shade. So he says at this time that there was a dearth of Talmidei Chachamim, right? You look around, there wasn't anybody else. Devorah was the one who stepped up, and Devorah came in there, and the way he describes it, he says also that people were a little bit hesitant, to come to Devorah. This was a new thing to have a woman who was in the lead, a woman who was in charge. There was no one else, though, to come to. Devorah was the greatest person around, so this was almost like, they didn't have a choice. It was no brainer, So even though they were hesitant, and even though there were certain things that were going against the tide that weren't the norm, but nevertheless, Bnei Yisrael realized that she's the greatest one around. She's the Nevi'ah, she's the Shofetah, she's the greatest one around. And therefore, even though this might be a little bit different than what we're used to, but this is what we have to do, this is what we have to go to. And it sounds like they were unified in that way. One last thing, and then we'll end for tonight. It's interesting that she's the Pasuk calls her a Nevi'ah, but there's very, very little in terms of her Nevu'ah that we hear about. Some Nevi'im, you have Yeshaya, Yechezkel, Yirmiyah, you have books and books and books of their Nevu'ah. Here you have Devorah, who was a Nevi'ah, and you have one perek, two prakim maybe, that describe, who she was and what her messages were. The Radak says that here, her Nevu'ah was specific for this generation. She wasn't a Nevi'ah. You don't find her nevuos written down because her nevuos were you have Yirmiyah and Yechezkel and these were Nevi'im, that their nevuos were important ledoros, and that's why they're recorded. That's what Chazal say. Whenever you have a Nevi'im, nevuos that are recorded in Nach is because those nevuos were hutzrichu ledoros. Those were necessary even for eternity. We also need the nevuos of Yirmiyah and Yechezkel and Yeshaya. Devorah was at a time, her nevuos were necessary for that time period. These weren't, nevuos about the Beis HaMikdash or Las Ilavo or long-term things. These were nevuos that were necessary for right now, and therefore her nevuos, you find some nevuos recorded now in terms of the battle with Yavin Melech Kenan and with Sisera and things like that, but it was more localized nevuah that was necessary for now, and therefore you don't have these big nevuos for later. Okay, so we'll Mitzvah Hashem will pick up next week with Pasuk Vav, continuing the story of Devorah.